I got up this morning and I thought that maybe I should change one of the readings to reflect on Noah's flood preparations. I didn't have time. Those of you who were here last Sunday may remember or may wonder if Brock and I got together to plan a two-parter about addressing fast-paced change in our society. We even both refer to Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam. The answer is no. But it is interesting that we both felt compelled to consider our fast-paced change in our world. And so we hold this dichotomy, some of those chaotic, abysmal, you know, readings about what's happening in the world, and being surrounded every moment by love. And so I will try to be pulling together those sort of disparate images and seeing if we can make some sense of it. If you read last week's bulletin, you may also wonder how it is that I'm here, as it indicated that I would be going to Uganda today. The remarkable scientific community has still not learned how to clone people, so fortunately, my trip to Lira actually takes place next Sunday, when we'll be going and celebrating with some remarkable women in a small town in Uganda and celebrating their lives and love. So not Noah, but I do have another story for the mix. Some of you may share my Catholic background, and so know the way in which tradition translates the New Testament stories of the sisters Mary and Martha, as told in Luke. Martha invites Jesus and his disciples into their home and prepares a meal for them, while Mary chooses to sit at the feet of Jesus to listen to him talk. Catholicism has translated this into the areas of active and contemplative vocations. Jesuits and Dominicans are example of active orders, the Marthas, who teach, enter medical professions, and do social service in the name of their God. Trappists and Carmelites are well-known monks and nuns who take vows of silence and live within the walls of cloisters to pray for all of humanity. Theirs include lives of mysticism. Silence, for us, a time to listen to that inner voice within. And action, a critical part of our commitment to social justice, are both very important. Brock spoke last Sunday of exciting ways in which UUs are moving forward with new ways to engage those other nuns, the N-O-N-E-S people who don't claim a particular religious tradition, with principles that we hold so dear. This morning, I will turn to the inner space that provides us with the strength we need to conduct all of our activities through the critically important path of love. I've set the scene with seemingly disparate images, music, and readings. Most of those photos I took, the flowers were all from my backyard and botanic gardens in New Zealand from last year. And the other images showing people in joy and in love were from around the world. You will probably recognize a few of them. If you're familiar with the last section of James Joyce's great novel, Ulysses, it's a 45-page sentence. No paragraph, no sentence punctuation, in which Molly's mind moves from seemingly disconnected thought to thought. So that mixture of Gershwin, Zoom, Coelho, Maransky, and verses in Luke may remind you of that passage. For me, they're tightly connected, so in the next 15 minutes, I'll try to make those connections more visible to you. My thoughts for this talk began from the graduate course I created this summer on social and economic contexts of education. Rather than the typical course, in which I usually include weekly readings from various researchers on topics I believe my students need to understand, topics such as political and ideological influences on public schools, unequal school spending, poverty, discrimination towards students of colors and other minority, I chose a book that came out this spring by well-known Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam, entitled Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. I chose it because he speaks directly to the topics of the course, economic and social issues that affect and create inequities in U.S. education. One of his major themes is that American society in the past, those good old days of the 50s and 60s, included communities in which neighbors knew one another, economic classes mixed, and there was more concern for all of the children in the community, helping them all to move up. I don't know about you, but when I heard this kind of thing when I was a kid in the 60s, it didn't do much for me. I told myself it never would. Now that I've probably lived over half of my life, ironically, I find myself in that same place I said I would never be, contemplating the 60s and 70s as those good old days, just as my parents did with the 40s and 50s. So with Gershwin, I echo, "You can't take that away from me." What was so good about them? First 8 years of my life were spent in rented apartments, trailers, and rented houses before my parents were able to finally mortgage a small three-bedroom home that they built in Western New York, where I lived till I was a high school freshman. And then we moved to Connecticut. All the neighbors knew one another. Almost none of the moms worked outside the home. Oh my gosh, don't I sometimes wish. They had their daily 10 a.m. coffee clatch together. And after school and all summer long, we kids would wander all over the neighborhood, playing kickball, hide and seek, climbing trees and bicycling, swimming in the lake. And our moms only knew we were somewhere in the neighborhood. The students I have now are afraid to let their children out of their sight, and they certainly know where they are at every moment. The recent arrest of a couple in, I think it was Virginia, who let their children walk by themselves to a park, indicates how far we have come from a belief in safety and freedom. And so, yes, I have come to believe in those good old days, and I'm grateful that not only I, but also my children, grew up in a space that we believed was safe and important for our children's development. This is reflected in Gershwin's "Someone to Watch Over Me," so beautifully played by Don. I made a collage to give myself a way of thinking about this service. The collage includes some images, and they may be hard really to pick out for you because there's too many there. I put too many together. But it includes images from the War on Poverty, Woodstock, the pill, tragedy from the Vietnam War, and the women's movement, all roughly 50 years ago. The more recent images there include those of Prozac, Occupy Wall Street, Caitlyn Jenner, U.S. citizens in the Southwest posting signs for Central American children to go home, and a white policeman sitting on a black teenage girl in Texas. In just 50 years, we have gone from a society in which premarital sex was damned to one in which it's commonplace. From a society in which our lesbian and gay friends were condemned to one in which they can finally marry. And we're called now to understand and protect our transgender friends and colleagues. A society in which our black friends have moved up in the civil rights era, only to be scapegoated in terrible and tragic ways through deaths of unarmed black men and boys in the past year. A time during which Muslims were not even given a second thought, to one in which some members of our society believe they are all evil. Less than 30 years ago, I recall learning my way around MS-DOS prior to the internet to type my children's school stories and those of their classmates. I taught part-time so I could be home to manage two children born 15 months apart, one with Asperger's syndrome, a diagnosis that was mostly unheard of at that time. Now, though I'm much older and would love to slow my work down, the remarkable pace at which I'm required to learn new technology for teaching and research makes my head spin, and frankly, it burns me out. I was working on a fall course on Friday, all day Saturday, and this wonderful software shows just how many hours I've spent on it. So I thought to look. 1 week of class for one of the courses I teach, I spent 16 hours on. 1 week of classes. It's pretty scary. I feel like the narrator of Coelho's novel, Aleph, who feels the craziness of current society. Akin to his opening remarks, my kids can't find jobs either that provide them with a living, I worry that my own retirement, even though I've worked since I was 16 years old, will be insufficient. I work with those who've suffered tragedies beyond what any of us can imagine in northern Uganda. And 30 years ago, I left a traditional religious spirituality that didn't offer me answers for the challenges of the present moment. This fast-paced change relates to themes of our story from all ages. We think we know, we're so sure we know, but there is so much going on, and we are often mistaken. I see this kind of thinking on a daily basis, a certainty that it evolves into judgment about people and events. We're all challenged by the almost narcotic effect of believing that we're right. Zoom, a 20-year-old children's story, is a lovely reminder that what we see is always an incomplete picture of the whole story. Our story is absolutely an important part of the whole, but we're not the center of the story, only a part. The story illuminates our seventh principle, our interdependence and our need to respect the connected web of life. This calls for humility, both in recognizing our often problematic reading of what we see, and in acknowledging that while we are a part of the story, we are rarely the center. My first title for this sermon was Reflection, Response, and Reverence. So far, we've reflected on remarkable amount of change that's occurred in the past 50 years. This reflection causes me to consider how to respond as Unitarian Universalists, which includes the need to revere what is given to us in this fascinating and confusing world. I turn to a Christian, a Buddhist, and a Jew to understand reverence. Mary of the New Testament chose contemplation of the words of her teacher. For me, the mystical words of Unitarian Universalism reside in our first and our seventh principles, the first of which we recited together this morning. We believe in the worth and dignity of every person. So closely connected is our seventh principle, a respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. You know, just as I've heard Catholics be criticized for these weekly recitations in their services, and people think they might not really be thinking about them, they're just sort of reading the words over and over, I sometimes wonder if we do that with our principles. How often have we thought about how hard the first principle is to live? Every person. Most of us are liberal in our thoughts and our politics. Our first principle requires us to confer worth and dignity to the Donald Trumps. I know, told you, this is hard. The Dick Cheneys, the KKK members who marched on Columbia, South Carolina last weekend, and to those sitting in a chair a row or two away from you that you might not like. To those who suggest that our religious movement is an easy one, I say that it is a remarkably challenging religion to aspire to. Rather than call these people's labels that I won't state from the pulpit, nasty labels, of which probably all of us are guilty of from time to time, it's our responsibility to recognize their dignity and their worth. In so doing, this may require a remarkable response to try to understand, to forgive, and to love. Buddhist John Merkansky offers us a path to a reverent response in his book, Awakening Through Love. As someone who spent over 20 years learning Buddhist meditation, he came to notice that our busy social world provides most face time to anger, hatred, and problems. Through his time in meditation and contemplation, he came to acknowledge that this is not a correct conception of the world. In fact, there is at least as much beauty and joy through the amazing amount of love bestowed on us, however imperfect, that we can begin with in order to move forward in our chaotic world with a sense of true love towards our world and our fellow companions on this earth. It's what I tried to depict in the photo showing kindness and love accompanying Gershwin's Can't Take That Away From Me, and in this morning's meditation. Merkansky makes clear that such love is not perfect. People are not perfect. People with whom we have problems, perhaps our own parents, have, at some time and imperfectly, shown us love at some point in our lives. At the end of our responsive reading, I concluded with words from the Jewish writer Viktor Frankl, who, in his book, The Search for Meaning, about surviving concentration camps, proclaimed, "A thought transfixed me. For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers, the truth that love is the ultimate and highest goal to which man can aspire." This man, like many of the Ugandans that I work with, endured the worst of human brutality. And yet he, along with the women and child survivors I know who survived Kony's Lord's Resistance War, found a remarkable way to move on. They were able to recognize the power of those who have loved them and that helped them let go of their rage and their terror. Marinsky challenges his readers to begin every day with a meditation recalling all of the ways in which others, close family, friends, teachers, store workers, spiritual leaders, and strangers have provided us with love. From a simple act of a help, a smile, or a profound revelation from our lives. He recommends that we focus on these acts of generosity rather than on what the media constantly puts in front of our faces. Images of anger, political buffoonery, cruelty, and pain. These challenging images are not to be ignored. Rather, girding ourselves with the oft-overlooked recognition that love surrounds us, we can move on with a positive and loving active response to the fast-paced challenges and socially unjust challenges that are part of our everyday lives.